Matt Richtel is the author of many books, many of which we have spoken about on KGNU, but his latest one is Dead on Arrival. And as with his previous novels, based on current technology, current science, but set in a little bit more of a dystopian future. But we're delighted to have Matt back in the studio, back home, because you're originally from Boulder.
I'm here. But I'm back.
You're back. He's back, everyone.
I'm back.
But you live in the technological hub of the Bay Area of San Francisco. And so how much do, you know, the power of technology companies, which is, you know, a theme of this book, how much does that play out in everyday life there? How much are people either directly connected to the tech industry where you live or just talking about it all the time?
Here, let me say this very broadly. San Francisco is Boulder with fewer Subarus. So it's just like your lives, but there are not as many Foresters and less snow, lots of rain. Direct connection, it's everywhere. You know, the guy two doors down is a lawyer for X company, and the guy, you know, across the street is does finance for Y company, and the fellow parents on the baseball team are involved in these companies, and my tennis partner is at a startup. I mean, it's in the fabric of the place right now.
And it's in the fabric of this place right now with the big Google campus and a lot of people also involved in tech startups. There are so many tech startups right here in Boulder, too. So there's quite a lot of similarities in terms of just people who are working for the industry.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this just before we came on the air. There is one of the beautiful things about technology is people are living and moving remotely. Now, I know you guys don't want, you know, Boulder inundated with people, you know, sitting with laptops at cafes who work for companies in,
newsflash, they're already here.
Newsflash. That is it. For those of you who have not heard, they're already here. You know, Portland, Seattle, Austin, and other places are feeling a similar kind of thing. And I actually think, I realize we're, when you and I talk, Maeve, we go all over the place. So should we just go all over the place?
We can. And then we'll focus it back into this book, Dead on Arrival, because it's one of those page-turning thrillers, as you are now known for, but really based in your, I suppose, your original career as a science and technology writer.
Yeah. So you're very, thank you for bringing it back to, I usually have to be the one who brings it back. I appreciate it. Yeah. So this draws from, well, can I describe the opening of it?
Please. And I'll get you to maybe read a little bit from the opening to give people a sense. Now, we're not going to give away the ending, but we're going to talk about the big themes that emerge in this book. And as we've said in previous books, you really skirt around the edges of what's happening currently in science and technology, but you kind of project a sinister end game to all of this.
Without sounding too glib, I mean, these are sort of, these books allow me to take clues that I pick up in my day job as a New York Times reporter and stitch them in ways that I couldn't write on the front page, but are not altogether, impossible for me to fathom or imagine. So just to set the scene, this book starts in Colorado. It starts at Hayden Airport in Steamboat, and a plane lands in the middle of the night, having come from San Francisco, and there's an infectious disease doctor at the back of the plane, and he gets a tap on the shoulder. He's asleep, and they say the flight attendant says a doctor's needed in the cockpit. He's a little woozy. He walks to the cockpit and they shut the door and he says, "You're looking for a doctor? Yes, let me show you something." Puts on those big bright outside lights in the plane, and on the tarmac there at Steamboat at Hayden Airport, there's a couple of bodies and a few more bodies in the terminal, and she turns off the light and she says, "Everybody not on this airplane is dead."
Now, the infectious disease doctor people, readers,
yes,
and listeners might think, oh, this is some type of disease that has broken out. But it really gets into the realm of technology, the impact of technology on us. And Google looms large in this because it flashes back in time and it shows a young, I suppose she's an engineer working for Google, and this whole program emerges. But why Google? Why did you want to bring technology into this as opposed to maybe like an Ebola style outbreak?
Well, I like to play with the idea of, well, first of all, I like to play with ideas that people haven't necessarily written about before. I don't mean to sound highfalutin in that respect, but there have been lots of things done about viruses. And I was interested in the idea that maybe there's something virulent in the way we are interacting with the modern world. There was one other key idea I want to mention here, and I'll come directly back to your question about Google. But I've been, after I wrote the beginning of that and started thinking about what was happening here, I became consumed, like just about everybody I know these days, with the hostility and partisanship and anger that is gripping people. And I really wondered, you know, is something going on that might affect our world and take the amplify that intensity, hostility, anger into something even more pronounced and virulent? And technology becomes the clue here. Why Google? I could have picked a lot of different companies to, you know, to focus on, but it's sort of the iconic company of our day right now. And you know, Google, like all of the companies that are in this space, and arguably even Maeve, what we're doing here, what the New York Times is doing, is focused fundamentally on getting attention. And the ways in which it gets attention are extremely powerful neurologically. I mean, they are drawing us in, captivating us, keeping our attention. And I started to think about what if those, to borrow a word I used earlier, what if those forces got amplified such that they had a virulent effect?
Well, you've written about this in your work as a journalist for the New York Times. You won the Pulitzer Prize for, is it Driven
go,
to Destruction?
Go on, Maeve.
Keep going. Matt Richtel's fan club. But Driven to Distraction, was that the title? It was about how we are being distracted in our cars, and there's, you know, the accidents that happen. But really, Google and the technology companies are part of this when we think of the maps that people are so used to now, GPS. And you've written so much about the impact on our brains and neurologically what is happening when we are exposed to so much technology. So what's the latest science coming out of that? Then we'll get back to the science fiction and the fiction aspect of this. But what is emerging now in science? What's happening to our brains with all of this technology?
Well, the latest science is more or less in line with what we've talked about before, which is that these devices are extremely compelling. I stop short of saying addictive. And I can explain why in a second if you're interested. But they're extremely compelling because they create novelty. They deliver social information, which is virtually hardwired into us, the need to get it. They create a kind of slot machine effect where you never know what you're going to get, if it's going to be good or bad. And what's changed since we last talked is not only have the devices become more powerful, the speed become better, but the amount of information and our reliance on it for virtually everything has grown. And so what that has done is that it's taken a device that facilitated some things and facilitated virtually everything. So it's hard as a user of these to even distinguish, what am I using it for at this given moment? Am I distracting myself? Am I bored? Am I using this for productivity? And the more it moves into the realm of necessary, the harder it becomes to distance yourself from it when it might be useful to do so, when it becomes in effect counterproductive.
This gets back to what we spoke about at the beginning, how so many people are working remotely. If you go to any coffee shop in San Francisco where you live, or Boulder here where you're from, there are so many people in cafes working on laptops or on their devices, and the lines are so blurred between work and between what's not necessary for work, because we're constantly flicking back and forth between Facebook. But then sometimes Facebook is for work because we got a post for this, but then we're looking at this and then we get a news alert. And the lines and the boundaries have been completely blurred, I think, when it comes to this.
I mean, how many times have you been in a conversation with your husband where he says, what are you doing right now? I am trying to ask you something. And you say, well, I just need to check one thing. I mean, I think that has become, you know, that might be the phrase of the decade. I just need to check one thing, which frankly is generally a lie. You don't really need to check one thing, but the compulsion to either be entertained, to have the dopamine squirt that we've talked about before, you know, that little burst of adrenaline that you start to crave in its absence, it's very powerful.
But one of the things I think that's really of concern and is the impact on kids, because now we have what we call digital natives, a whole generation of folks who know nothing but this technology, where we can remember life before Google, life before everyone had a computer/phone in their pocket. Now we've got kids who are being exposed to this younger and younger, children who have smartphones in their pockets. What is the science about what's it doing to them neurologically? Is it still too early to know?
Yeah, the hard science remains too embryonic to tell us anything. But there is some soft science, some survey data, and some other information that's a little bit frightening. For instance, if you talk to, there's been numerous studies talking to teachers that will say they feel that their children, the children they teach have had diminishing attention spans. You'll also see, you're a parent of kids who are roughly the age of my kids, 9 and 7, and the arguments that go on over the device is kind of the proof in the pudding of how compelling these things are. I think if my kids had to choose, they would choose the device over a bowl of ice cream. And that's an extraordinary statement. And it also is neurologically is demonstrable because you can see parts of the brain light up, the reward centers of the brain light up when people are eating sugar, and you can see it light up when they're interacting with their devices. Both of these things go through the reward centers of the brain. They involve dopamine. Now, that's not that, you know, that's not a fancy word. Dopamine is involved in lots of pleasurable experiences. But the problem is when it overtakes, those pleasurable experiences overtake something you'd rather be doing, say driving or having your kids read, which requires a certain level of investment. So long answer to that I can do more briefly, we don't know the hard science yet. The short science says limit your kids' exposure to the devices so that they have the ability to use their imaginations, to be outside.
Do your kids have devices?
Can I take the fifth or no comment? No, they do not have devices, but we argue about it all the time with them. And we've actually been advised. We've asked someone, we've asked a counselor, what do you recommend? We struggle with this. And they will say, believe it or not, limit it to 15 minutes at a time. And we my wife and I look at this person and go, you've got to be kidding me. It will be the civil war in our house. You know, there will be pitchforks but that's part of parenting today. You have to be as tough on that as you are with junk food.
And especially when you're seeing kids in schools, it seems like the boundaries of how young kids are getting these devices, it's going backwards. It's getting younger and younger and younger. So before, maybe in middle school, you'd have that battle because all the other kids have a device. Now in elementary school.
I think the schools is a great point, and I would encourage people to think about what we've tried to think about as parents involved in our school district. The schools have this idea that they can raise money if they sell it on the basis of getting the newest thing. But there is no, let me rephrase that, there is limited evidence that technology in the schools is useful for core learning. So it can be used under certain circumstances, but I would not fall for the idea that your kids need more computers in schools. That is not demonstrable yet by a lot of science. And the problem is, again, like all of society, we are all heading herd-like in the direction of shiny, bubbly, you know, blinky, soundy. Is soundy a word, Maeve?
It is now, I guess.
So be cautious of that. Can I just add a caveat? This is not intended to be an anti-technology screed. I say that a bunch, and I hear that those words echoing in my brain because I know it can come off like that. It's not intended that way. It's the stuff that I have learned suggests that, you know, the technology can be super, super powerful, just like food, and it can be junk food just like food. So you got to pick your spots.
We're speaking with Matt Richtel this morning here on KGNU. He's a science and technology journalist, writes for the New York Times, won a Pulitzer Prize for his work on this particular issue. But he's also known for writing books, that novels that are very much based on current science, current technology. His latest book is Dead on Arrival. And just reading from the cover, while they were in the air, the world changed. Then they landed dead on arrival. So it starts at an airport in Steamboat Springs in Colorado. The airplane lands and everyone appears to be dead.
There's an infectious disease specialist at the back of the plane. And I love this character. I learned about this character from talking to some doctor friends of my wife, who's also a doctor. And this character has a core conflict. And his conflict is that having been an infectious disease specialist for many years, he's not sure that he cares to help people anymore. And the reason he's not sure he cares to help people anymore is he discovered, working with infectious disease, that infectious diseases, viruses, bacteria, worms, parasites, are actually, he finds them more honest than human beings. They declare their intentions. I want to eat and destroy. Whereas people are very People will come into the emergency room having gotten into drunk driving wrecks, having shot each other, having yelled and screamed and been hostile and harmed each other. And he's not sure he wants to help the kind of humanity that is tearing itself apart right now. Again, this sets the backdrop for the political landscape of this book. And so he is trying to decide, even as this book goes on, do I want to discover what's going on, or should I just leave this dead world in front of me to rot? And he has to go outside of the plane, in effect, do medical investigations, a kind of, a medical investigation on the ground of the folks who are dead or catatonic or imperiled in some way, and discover what's going on.
Well, he is an investigator and he pieces all of this together. And in terms of medical practitioners nowadays looking at connections to stuff, I mean, is technology and is what's happening neurologically, particularly with kids, which we've talked about, is that part now of the lexicon of discovery when a doctor is doing their history in terms of, okay, you're presenting with this. Typically we ask about lifestyle choices or food or activities. Is technology now on that list?
You know what's interesting about that question? I'm actually going to flip it. What's interesting about it is, I think to some extent with kids, that is a big part of the discussion and behavioral issues when pediatricians come in. But interestingly enough, doctors are trying to heal themselves on this score. And there's been really, since we last talked, there's been some really interesting research into the extent to which doctors are getting distracted by their devices. A case out of Denver that I wrote about for the New York Times involved a surgeon who was watching the 40-year-old virgin during a surgery. I kid you not.
The movie.
I wish you could have seen Maeve's face here. Maeve gave me the you gotta be kidding me look. But yes, the movie on his phone, and created an injury that I'm going to be cautious here. I'm going to say something that sounds hyperbolic, but I believe it to be true. It's been a while since I wrote this, but I believe it led to some paralysis in the patient.
Now, were there not other people in the surgery suite at this point to point out, that's not appropriate to do a movie while you're doing surgery, to watch a movie while you're doing surgery on someone?
I believe there were people in there, and I think this led to a lawsuit. But here's the thing, Maeve, it was not altogether isolated. There were some figures that came out through a survey not long afterwards that said anesthesiologists and radiologist techs and others who are in these surgeries were not infrequently looking at their devices. So, this just goes to the question of compulsion to use this stuff. When you feel as if you have a moment of boredom, it draws you in, even if you're under circumstances where it just seems unreal.
Well, I'm going to get you to read a little bit from Dead on Arrival, not to freak people out even more about what's actually happening. This is fiction, but as we said, it's always based very much in current science, current technology. Is there a passage you think that you could scare our listeners even further with?
Yeah, let me scare our listeners. Would you like to just hear that first moment when they...
Let's do that. The opening scene when they arrive at Steamboat Airport.
So they arrive at Steamboat Airport, and now we've met this doctor, Lyle Martin, and he is, let's just say he's working through some issues that I alluded to earlier, but he's also got maybe some substance abuse issues that are coloring his view of things. And he's brought up to the cockpit, and the next sort of page goes like this. The flight attendant knocked on the flight deck door. A small slider window opened, giving way to an eye. The flight attendant explained she had the doctor, and the eye blinked. Lyle heard a woman's voice faintly say, "Step aside and let him in." Lyle looked back at the plane load of passengers to see many of them craning into the aisle to glean his purpose. He walked into the flight deck. It was dark, outside at least. Inside, the controls remained lit up, somewhat, a handful of red lights. The air hung stale. Seated to his left in a tan chair, a woman, he thought, though her back was to him. She must be the pilot. To his right, facing him, sat the navigator or co-pilot or whatever. Between them and overhead, a dense instrument panel that looked like the electrical version of wall-to-ceiling carpeting. In front of each pilot, two screens, each black. Between them, a big handle which Lyle presumed to be the throttle. Other than that, it was Greek to him. "I'm Lyle Martin." "Eleanor Hall, and this is the first officer, Jerry Weathers. You're a doctor?" "Yes," he thought. Doctor-ish, enough of one, used to be. Maybe that's why they kept asking him, to see if it was still true. "Is someone sick?" Eleanor reached down to her right to the control panel and flipped a white switch. Outside, there was an explosion of bright, the airplane's headlights. They illuminated a swath of pavement, the tarmac. A second later, she turned off the light. But the images were burned into Lyle's drug-tinged brain. A man in an orange jumpsuit lying on the ground beside a luggage transporter. Two other workers toppled upon each other. A desolate hangar to the right. And the clincher, inside the window of a small airport, a half dozen would-be passengers or staff, motionless. As near as we can tell, Eleanor said, everyone out there is dead.
That's author Mac Richtel reading from his new book, Dead on Arrival. Now, the opening of the book, it seems that there's been some catastrophic medical event that's happened. But as we will discover, if you read the book, that technology has got a big part of this. Now, Google looms large, and particularly a secret program of Google.
Yep.
This seems to tap into a lot of mistrust that seems to be out there about these huge technology companies, whether it's Facebook or Google, the control they have over our lives,
yeah.
What they're doing with the information that we're freely giving them because of all this technology that we're surrounded by. Why did you want to kind of talk about that? Or what do you see in society right now in terms of our relationship with these large technology companies?
I think what I see very broadly is a non-critical look at our relationship with these companies. I think they are making a trade-off with us that we are making in some cases far too willingly. And the trade-off is we will give you services for free. You give us our attention. And I'm just not sure that we collectively have understood the extent to which attention is currency. And it is extremely valuable. Now, it is valuable in a tiny respect to Google, our individual. Collectively, it's worth a lot, but our individual attention is extremely valuable because we only have so much of it to spend. It is finite. And we are giving it away or trading it for services that may not serve us as much as the value of our attention would otherwise recommend.
And are you seeing a mistrust now? I mean, we're seeing a lot of lawsuits. Like today, a privacy watchdog group filed a complaint with the FTC over Google's system for tracking purchases on the internet, but also in physical store locations, because when we have these devices, of course, they're also GPS trackers. And so our every move essentially is being tracked. But are you seeing not conspiracy theories as much as just a distrust of what they're actually capable of doing? Is that emerging now?
You know, I mean, quite honestly, Maeve, I'm not. I mean, I think that there is a, you know, this, that we are moving, I said it earlier, but I'll say it again, herd-like in the embrace of this stuff, and partly because it is so efficiency providing. For instance, you mentioned, you know, like an e-wallet, you might not have to have cash. That provides you seconds. I mean, you just go down the list where you are getting seconds of your life. The question is, what are you going to do with those seconds? Before I harp on that theme, because I'm starting to sound like a broken record, let's go back to mistrust. I'm just not seeing the mistrust. In fact, over the years at the New York Times, we've had a conversation. Should we be doing stories about how people feel about this quote-unquote invasion of privacy? But if you talk to people, they are loving the trade-off that they're making. They're getting Facebook and they're corresponding with people. Look, I'm using Facebook to market this book, and I use Facebook to correspond with friends, and many people do the same with Twitter. I don't think we're being particularly critical about that because we feel like we're getting something very good.
Well, this book talks about a secret program.
Yes.
That Google has.
Yes.
Do you think there are secret programs at these large technology companies that are even more nefarious than what we actually know they're doing?
Can I take off my New York Times hat?
Please do.
I absolutely think there are secret programs, but I think that lots of companies have secret programs and they develop things. But look, just to bring this out into the open, when a couple of years ago when I was writing about the addictive nature of, not that it's addictive, but the addictive nature of our devices, I had people at high levels of major technology companies tell me, we know this stuff has addictive properties. We know that it gives you dopamine. We know that it plays to your reward centers. So you cannot tell me, you just can't tell me that they're not trying to perfect the capability of these things to draw us in. It's just not possible. Now, is that a secret project? I don't know. Are they working on, you know, are they working on the kinds of stuff with like subliminal ads? I have no idea. Are they, you know, I'm not sure they would look at even these questions as even being that nefarious. They're probably secret, but I don't think they'd see them as nefarious. They look at it as a trade-off. We give you stuff, you give us your attention.
You mentioned earlier that you actually wouldn't categorize a lot of this stuff as being addictive. Why?
But, well, a good question. And I had to think a lot about that and ask a lot of questions. The reason is because there's a very clear clinical definition of the word addictive. And it's something that the folks who write the diagnostic manual for medicine have wrestled with. They make a demarcation between substances and behaviors. Substances can be addictive, and part of the reason why they meet that definition is because they alter or diminish your gray matter. They actually degrade your brain. By contrast, let me move it out of technology for a second to draw the contrast. Gambling is a behavior. For a long time, that didn't meet the definition of addiction because you couldn't see the degradation of brain material. For the first time, that is starting to make it into the medical vernacular as an addiction. So that is one reason I don't call this addictive, because medicine itself has a clearer clinical definition that this doesn't fit. You can't see degradation of the brain when you interact with your device.
Well, in terms of what all of this is doing to us culturally, you touch on in the book things that are already out there, albeit not necessarily ubiquitous. Driverless cars,
yep.
You know, robotic technology. And those are the things I think that are difficult for us mentally to fully embrace. I mean, I think there is some type of line right now that people aren't quite ready to cross.
Yes. Can I come back to that? Because there is one thing culturally that I'm glad you brought up culture, because one of the things that's in this book, but just in the spirit of our conversation, I think is very powerful, is I think it's impacting our politics in a very pronounced way. I mentioned the backdrop of this book is the partisanship and and actually, if I can find it, can I just read you a quick passage? Because I'm going to tie it to technology.
Please do.
I want to connect this to the way media is impacting us and impacting our culture and what's happening in this country. So as Lyle, the doctor, is looking out the window, his first impulse is to think this must be an armed attack. He says, on one level, of course, it was natural that people would speculate about armed attack or terrorism, especially if someone had seen a body. It was everywhere now, the violence, hardening people and accelerating a non-virtuous cycle. People wanted more police power, then feared government power and purchased more guns. Frustrated citizens hewed more tightly to the views that, perversely, accelerated the trend further. More cops, more guns, more guns, more cops. And what does this have to do with technology? I mean, I think this will be obvious to people, but I'll just give you a crazy statistic. In 2016, the amount of media consumed per week in the United States was 72.5 billion minutes. It was up 18% from the year prior. So what does this have to do with partisanship? Well, I think everybody, you know, you can imagine what the answer is. As we move to our own separate corners and embrace the media that makes us, you know, that validates us or gives us the answers we want or represents our viewpoint, we can become more incensed, more hostile, get our backs up against the wall. And then when we come across someone else who has a different view, we're already in a defensive crouch.
You mentioned guns there, and there's a character in here who's very attached to his Second Amendment rights.
Yes.
There's kind of a survivalist attitude about when the end of the world comes, whether it's from technology or some other apocalyptic thing, we're going to have our guns. And that looms large in there. And you often don't think about the two being connected.
I think they are. And, you know, I've got a family member in California who's very progressive, very liberal, and said to me not that long ago, look, I've got my guns and I practice with my guns. It's not just the conservative you might imagine or the Colorado libertarian you might imagine. You know, there are people on both sides of the aisle saying, I'm going to be ready. And if you think about it, it becomes, you know, in some way self-prophesizing that you have hostility, you have people who are armed, you have a lot of anger. And these things can play to each other. Just one more thing that I've been playing around with, and this falls under the area of fiction and speculative, but why this level of anger, why this level of hostility? I think we're getting keyed up in part by our devices. I think we're not able to live through moments of boredom. And in that space comes a lot of this invitation of media that can get us really worked up.
Well, let's end on a positive note.
Well, let's do it.
It's always kind of a dystopian future that you portray in your books.
Wait,
but
hold on.
Is there?
It all ends well.
It all ends well. There's a happy ending, folks. So dead on arrival.
Not dead on arrival.
Alive on the ending. But in terms of what we're actually living through now in society, though,
yes.
What are some of the positive areas that we should look at?
Well, broadly speaking, very broadly speaking, I think we learn. And I think we learn as a society. We've learned about food. We've moved out of fiefdoms into democracy. We're going to learn. We have powerful tools in front of us. They are helping with medicine. Look, I know driverless cars scare some people, but if we wound up with effective driverless cars, 30,000 some people die a year on the roadways, and several hundred thousand have serious injuries. It is the most dangerous thing you will do all day and maybe in your entire life. We might be able to cure that epidemic. There are a million things that technology is doing well. The question is, can we enslave it rather than have it enslave us? I mean, that is the core question. You know, I think to lend on a positive note, to the focused go the spoils.
That will be the last word. Matt Richtel's latest book is Dead on Arrival. We'll put a link at our website so you can find out more information. Matt, thank you.
Thank you, Maeve.